It's time to come together again, fellow White Scarves. Welcoming to our ranks is someone outside the normal Marvel canon thus far, but I think you'll agree, her persona is appropriate. Based on the Justice League sorcerer and adept of backwards magic, I give you the Princess of Punching, Mighty Magician. This is White Scarves Team Up. Hello, listeners, and welcome to a new White Scarves team-up. This time, not just a fan, but one of the voice actors that has graced us with bringing voice to many different characters in the new century, but in particular, our favorite, Princess Gwendolyn. Let me introduce Theo Lee.
Hello, everyone.
Theo, it's great to have you here. You were the first to jump on the bandwagon, even though we have a long time to go in before we get to The Princess Thieves, wherein you play the leading role of the titular princess. But as Toby so helpfully compiled the list of all of the voices that you have given... Uh-oh.
Oh, that's the first one to go of the evening.
This time they're trying to get through the door, Toby. That's concerning.
It's fine. I sharpened a broomstick handle that tends to work.
No. You're going to get the blood on you. Don't you remember anything? You have to hit them with a bludgeoning implement.
Bring your finest head-bashing implements.
Greg, you got to watch this splatter, Toby.
We haven't gotten to the cartographer's handbook. I need to do some revising.
Yeah. Well, okay. So... obviously, listeners, one of the things I was about to get into, Theo does voice Amanda Culver in Let Them Go, which new listeners would have heard at this point. And we have already recorded almost all the episodes that we're going to be doing on the following book, Secret Rooms. However, we are going to be discussing almost all parts of New Century at this point. So spoilers in the episode doobly-doo as well, but I'm going to say it again here. If you have not read the entire series and you do not want to be spoiled, this is still going to be a great interview, but you want to jump out now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Also, spoilers for our opinions of upcoming stories and Theo's performances in them. They're great. Let's talk.
Yes, exactly. Something that I had not necessarily remembered from when Alex had graciously sent me links to, or rather the sound files for, all of the previous roundtables, some of which are no longer available for even Patreon listeners anymore. Theo, you have an interesting story that you were a fan of New Century first, answered a casting call, and as of Princess Gwendolyn, fit very neatly into the established cast of six as a regular. And I'd like to ask you about that experience, going from being a fan to being a voice actor. But before we get into that, maybe you can remind me. There's this thing that they put at a crossroads that they put criminals into.
Oh,
can you remind me what that is?
How dare you?
Greg, we've lost him.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm sorry. Bye. I gotta go. No. Yeah. See, I'd never seen the word gibbet. I'd seen the word gibbet, but I'd never heard it pronounced. So I had no frame of reference. And I knew it was like an instrument of torture,
yeah,
or, you know, execution. But like I said, I never heard it spoken out loud. But then my brain just would not let go of the hard G. Mm-hmm. My brain just refused. They revolted. And it led to 3 minutes of hilarity.
I'll be completely honest. I was not familiar with the word before the story was made public, and we're so sorry for that. But I still struggle with remembering, wait, which one is the right pronunciation again? And whenever I was reading it or looking back on notes, I read it aloud in my head as gibbet, and I thought, oh, okay, yeah, I can completely see what happens here, because when you look at it on a piece of paper, which you have to do, it looks like gibbet.
I've never had a problem with it, but I also don't remember where I first heard the word, so, yeah.
All right, well, listeners, you let us know. Are you hashtag team gibbet or hashtag team gibbet?
It's gif all over again.
for those people that are not aware, for the three people that don't know what this means, there was a very specifically an issue with recording this line originally, and there was an extended blooper reel that Alex added to the roundtable for Christmas Thieves and Let Them Go. It's so much fun to listen to. I may or may not ask Alex if I can put that little snippet in here, because it is one of those Patreon extras. And of course, I want to encourage people that have become fans of New Century to do a solid and, you know, put a little money towards this wonderful thing that we all love. But, you know, that's for the future. That's for future editor Greg. No worries there. As it turns out, the entire roundtable is available on the New Century Podbean feed, so the show notes will have a link to that there. Theo, please tell us about your experience of going from fan to actress.
Well, I'd been listening to the School of Movies, which sort of morphed from Planet Gonzo to Digital Drift. I'd been listening to that for ages. And Alex started talking about this project he was working on, and I was like, oh, that sounds interesting, but it sounds like it involves zombies, and I'm zombied out, so I'm just going to give it a pass. And I didn't give it a pass. I thought, well, I'll just listen to the first episode, and then I didn't stop listening. Mm-hmm. And it speaks to how Alex is talented in taking a genre like a zombie apocalypse / werewolf, vampire, whatever you want to call the Wendigos. Mm. It's a genre that I'm still kind of sick of it because there's so much of it out there. But the way Alex has shaped this world, especially the setting, I'd never seen one set not in the modern era. And the setting where everything was still very contentious after the Civil War, that's a tinderbox. And then you throw this plague of monsters into it, and everything goes to hell in the most interesting ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just listened to it, and it's just up until Alex had put out the casting call for someone who could do British accents, I'd never considered doing anything like this before. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a person who goes out and performs. I've never been that way. Like most voice actors, I hear them talk about, oh, yeah, I used to get in trouble in school for making funny voices and being a class clown, and now I get paid for it. Ha ha.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, yeah, that's funny. But I got in trouble in school, but for completely different reasons. I was never outgoing. I'd never attracted attention to myself because that led to bullying and getting in trouble. And so...
Yeah, we don't have any sympathy for that here, do we, Toby?
Yeah, no, we have no experience with that whatsoever.
It's just never been my propensity. And I surprised myself because I'd been sort of doing a British accent in private to myself, just reading my own stuff aloud, just sort of practicing because it helps with a stutter, I found out.
Oh.
I used to have a really bad stutter, especially when I still do. Like, you can hear it. But it used to be a really big problem. And for some reason, it's some kind of neurological thing. You speak with a different accent or you take on a vocal affectation, it stops the stutter because your brain has to work around a different path.
That's a new one on me. I'd heard that there are people that sing as part of therapy to overcome stutter, but not an accent. All right.
Yeah, it's very weird. So I thought privately to myself, you know, I think my British accent sounds good, but I could be wrong because Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins has been
not a good show.
richly roasted for his performance as Bert. I thought what was going to happen is I was going to send over these like little monologues, and he was going to say, "Thanks, but no thanks. We're good." Mm. But his response was, "Where have you been?" And I was like, "What?" So I guess I'm a voice actor now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you began with sending him recordings of your British accent, the first time we actually hear you was playing Truth Arlington. So did he do a casting call for Gwendolyn and then you came back in to do Truth later on, or how did that work?
Yeah, see, I kind of hedged my bets. I recorded two random stage monologues in a British accent, and then one from a Tennessee Williams play. I think it was...
Oh, okay.
For those of you curious at my reaction and may not be aware of his name,
Tennessee Williams is a 20th century playwright and is responsible for works you may have heard of, like A Streetcar Named Desire and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. His name actually came up while preparing the final episode for Secret Rooms, because I suddenly became aware of the subgenre called Southern Gothic.
In, like, a slightly exaggerated, my natural Southern accent,
mm-hmm.
I rounded out all the vowels and put more drawl in it, and that became truth. You know, just in case he needed someone else, like, you know, Southern accent, if the British one didn't work out.
Well, you were two for two there, because yeah, both of them sound like they hit the mark.
Truth is kind of based on, like, what I imagine my grandmother might have sounded like when she was younger. She had a very classic Southern, old Southern accent. And the way she spoke was just very measured and calm and precise. And it was just very genteel. There are still some sounds that she made that I can't make. Mm-hmm. Like the way she would say the word ruin. She would say run.
Huh.
Wow. And
run. Like you gotta run your hose. You shouldn't walk through those bushes, darling. You're going to ruin your hose. And you know, just that kind of thing. And I'm not even saying it right, but it's very strange vowel sounds that used to be very commonplace around here, but aren't anymore.
The sort of way of interpreting and repurposing words so that they fit into a sentence rather than they are a word in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Huh. Okay. Some of that conversation is already running into some of our other topic, but Toby, take us straight into question two.
All right, then. We've often heard that the characters undergo alterations once they're in the hands of the people voicing them. Have there been many instances of that happening with the characters you voice? And if so, who would you say went through the most significant transformation through your conversations with Alex?
I think Gwen... Simply because the character herself, went through a very defined arc. Like, she started as one thing and ended up with a completely different worldview and sort of outlook.
And was that always the intended arc?
Yeah. He had the arc planned out. And we started recording sessions over Skype, and he would direct me over Skype. That helped guide how Gwen sounded from point to point. It's subtle, but... It's been a while since I listened to The Princess Thieves, but as I remember it, she starts out very, you know, sort of more sprightly, the way she talks, and by the end, she's much more measured and even keeled, I think. I could be making things up in my head, so.
No, I would say that I wouldn't necessarily have noted. I would have to, we would actually have to get in deep and re-listen to The Princess Thieves to see if there's a marked difference in the tonality of the way she talks. She definitely goes through a major emotional shift that is particularly hard-hitting. It's like one of the things that I like to mention with Alex, and I probably cover with Toby a little bit, is that it takes a hugely dramatic shift the second Robin takes his mask off and shows us the boy inside Sussex. And it's... I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the exact change for Gwendolyn, because she has a lot of other key points along the way. But it's definitely one of those things where the story seems like one thing right up until a certain point, and then it takes a darker turn and reminds you that it's still a part of the overall theme and story of New Century. So, yeah, I can definitely get behind that. But as to whether Toby or I can note the differences in the way you voice act Gwen, both before and after major changes, we'd probably have to do a deep dive on that.
But if only we had a platform from which to do a deep dive of Princess Thieves.
Toby, you're British, now scale it down a bit.
Oh, of course. So sorry.
All right, that takes us into number three. Go ahead, Toby.
Okay, so... you mentioned your grandmother as an influence on Truth and her character and how you play her, but what are some of the other big influences on your approach to voice acting in general and how you portray certain characters?
I watch a lot of British comedy, like panel shows like QI and Mock the Week. And a lot of the comedians, let's see, Sandy Toksvig, I think my accent is influenced a lot by her, which is interesting because her accent is actually fake. She's not actually British. Oh, gosh, there was another one. I can't remember her name, but there's like a couple other British comedians that have this very, Sharon called it posh sort of accent. And it turns out that's the only British accent I can do.
But it works so well because both those comedians and the general tone of Princess Thieves is not only comical, but it's about sort of projecting from a stage. It has that theatricality to it, which there are, obviously, Princess Thieves, like any story that's going to be told in this universe, will have a grounded reality to it. But Princess Thieves is always feels like you're going to a pantomime in a sense, and you're getting to like experience these characters who simultaneously are real and just excessive as shit. And that's great. So I think it works really well to draw that influence. And I can totally hear it now that you mention it.
I'm less experienced with Rock the Week, but I've seen a few instances of QI primarily because it was Stephen Fry that was hosting it for a while. And one of my favorite experiences of that was a panel with a bunch of people I mostly didn't recognize, but also Emma Thompson. And it was Alan Rickman that came up. And one of the people on, a man named John Sessions, who I've never seen anywhere else, started doing this amazing, not quite exact imitation, but pretty close of Alan Rickman as he was playing Hans Gruber in Die Hard.
What he says, after he shot the man, says, Mr. Kage, I will count to three. There will not be a four. And he shoots the head and then he goes downstairs later and he goes, Mr. Takagi won't be joining us for the rest of his life.
And then this one moment.
I've seen what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. This one moment where he's being interrogated by this little boy at a party. Alan! Yes. How come you always play villains? I don't play villains. I play very interesting people. And that's me doing the imitation of his imitation, so I have no idea how that's going to sound on recording, so...
If nothing else, we're providing all our listeners with some great YouTube clip suggestions.
Yeah, no, that one of the things we definitely try to do is put links in the doobly-doo for people to enjoy. If we come across anything that's going to be of educational value or just straight-up entertainment value.
I tend to lean more on the entertainment, and Greg is the more educated of the two of us in terms of what we present.
Educated? You're the one that's actually going for a PhD. I never finished college.
There's different kinds of smarts.
Yeah, no, that's true. So, number four, we've started to nibble around the edges of truth. Truth butts heads with a number of characters we're invested in, but nevertheless is undoubtedly a voice in the room that is so important to have present, and we always feel for her. You mentioned as one of the things in the roundtable, she was the easiest to do because you identify a lot with her. What is the balance of her character, and how does she differ from you?
I think her character is informed a lot by her relationship with her father, and she may disagree with him, but she has a great deal of respect for him nonetheless. That doesn't mean she's going to just fall in line and do what he says. She's going to say what she thinks, no matter what. And I have a feeling Thomas himself instilled that quality in her. You don't go along with everything somebody says just because they're in charge. You need to speak up for what you believe is right. Do the critical thinking and speak up. You know, even if it's against your own father, speak up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to teach myself how to do that with my own father, because he was of the do as I say, this is my house, my rules kind of person. And I had to learn how to do that. It didn't go great, but it is definitely something that I feel when playing truth. It's like, I don't agree with you, and here's my 12-point list of why.
Did that make it more difficult if you were drawing upon personal experience that did not have a quote-unquote happy ending?
Kind of, but the way I deal with difficult stuff like that is to express it in some way. And the artistic, like, I do a lot of writing and fanfic, but...
But
a lot of my characters have difficulties that I used to have or still have, and the way they often express it in ways that I wish I could, and that's how I deal with it.
Mm. By the way, don't feel bad about writing fanfic. I wrote a ton of Transformers fanfic in my 20s, not even when I loved it when I was a kid. So please don't ever stop writing.
Oh, I haven't stopped.
Oh, good, good, good.
In fact, I'm doing some right now.
I just don't share it with the world.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. One of the things that Arlington is based on is the far more modern TV show The West Wing. And mm-hmm. Truth, I feel, encapsulates a bit of a couple of the characters that are absolutely concerned with the message that government, the White House, is putting out, and as well as someone that is trying to present a more even-handed message as opposed to the more radical message that Thomas was always trying to push for. Did you watch The West Wing, and did that inform on your presentation of Truth?
Oh, yeah. I watched a ton of that when I lived at home with my parents, when it was airing, in fact. They were big fans. I wouldn't say they absorbed the messages, but they were big fans.
Yeah.
But yeah, I watched a lot of that, and I big misconception of how the White House actually operates.
I've always viewed it as being a more ideal world.
Yeah.
And during the time of the Bush administration and even after the Bush administration, this always felt like the kind of world that we wanted to live in and mm-hmm. was never realized. Now, in particular, it feels like this system is breaking down at every level, and the West Wing feels almost a little bit quaint in conception these days because it doesn't feel like even they went far enough at the time in comparison to how it feels things should be now. There are many more things I could say as to why the West Wing is difficult to watch, especially now, and I will, but Toby and I will get into that when we discuss Arlington. For now, let's move on. Alex has talked in the past about how he wanted at some point to try and set up a false trail to suggest that Truth could be the person behind White's mask, but it doesn't seem like anyone ever bit on that false trail for various reasons. Did Alex ever communicate this idea to you, and were there any ways you attempted to bring this idea to life in your voice acting, if so?
We discussed it. I'm not sure how much I should say.
Well, so at this point, obviously the entire story of White has yet to be revealed because part of it is going to be in Stone Spring Maidens and his confrontation with Harry. But yeah.
Also, we haven't done with the audio version of Uncivil Outlaw. So, you know, wait on this particular thread if you're listening
yeah, I have a feeling if I say anything more, Alex is going to come bursting through my wall, Kool-Aid Man style, and go, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Okay, I can't contain it anymore. It's Carl, everyone, it's Carl!
It's me, you fuckos!
Rips off the mask. It's Gwen, it's been me the whole time.
What? That doesn't even make sense.
Surprise, bastards, it was me, the nag.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
That's better.
Yeah, okay.
How did the mask fit on?
Magic. Okay. I don't have to explain anything.
So wait, would the white mask fit on the front of his head or up his head? Yeah, no, okay, fair enough. I read the book Uncivil Outlaw a day after it released, and I guess I shouldn't assume that everybody was going to intake it the same way. When we had a fan conversation with Nick Ord, he mentioned how he was never a fan of audiobooks, and only after reading everything up to Uncivil Outlaw, I sort of had to, you know, convince him to come around, and he's a fan now, but there are probably still people out there that may have waited for the audio drama rather than reading the text, so we'll move swiftly along from there. I have since learned that a stunning majority of White Scarves do, in fact, wait for the audio drama. Only a handful of people responded with commentary after the ebook came out in January, so it would seem the audio drama is the preferred media. Reading was my constant companion when I was younger, so perhaps I am unusual in that regard. I'm not sure I can complain that much, though. If there had been more conversation on the School of Movies Discord server, I might never have jumped into Toby's DMs, and he might never have proposed a podcast. I think this is the better possible outcome as a result. Toby, take us to question number 5.
Okay, so Amanda is a character we care about a lot and who is very important to most of the principal characters of Let Them Go. When she is bitten and she begins her transformation into one of the Barghest, because we like to switch up that word and keep our listeners on their toes, that is not only very painful for the audience to see, but has the added significance of being positioned as the first character in the series we see succumb to the infection of these creatures, since Let Them Go is framed as a new starting point. How did you approach her journey throughout the book and her heartbreaking transformation in particular?
Well, the physicality, so to speak, of the performance came from my experience getting a really gnarly case of food poisoning.
Oh no.
And my parents were out of town, so I couldn't call them. And I was so sick that I forgot I had a sister-in-law. Wow. That I could call.
Oh. That there was enough of a pause there that sounded way more serious than it was.
Yeah, it's like I was like, oh geez, my brother's out of town, my parents out of town, I can't call anybody to come take me to the doctor. Guess I'm out of luck. I completely forgot about my sister-in-law. But yeah, it's just the way I had to move myself around the house when I was just that sick and just dehydrated, couldn't keep anything down, and anytime I had to make a noise, that the way that I felt, that was how I imagine Amanda might be feeling as this infection is taking over. And so I sort of drew on that. But mentally, it's like Amanda has to be wondering, is as it gets worse and worse, as she loses more and more of herself, that is this going to be it? Am I going to die? And she's trying to keep that tamped down, I guess, to, I don't know, just like reassure her sister or just not panic. I don't really know. That was one of the ones that Alex and I coordinated on Skype for. So he sort of guided me through that. Mm-hmm. And I had to sound slightly drunk, which is interesting because I've never been drunk.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I had to go off, you know, seeing friends get tipsy. So
props to you. It's really convincing as the middle chapters of the book that Amanda is just slowly drifting in this foggy haze where certain truths are coming to her and just coming out of her. And I think it's some of the hardest chapters to listen to, honestly, because we get to see Amanda for several chapters and you are just starting to get used to the idea of a full story with her. And then when she's bitten, you see her twist into something else. So I'm not really going to any particular destination with this. It's just the continued purpose of this interview is to say, oh, Amanda's so good. You did such a good job. Oh.
And we feel, especially considering how that story ends up, we never knew as much about or delved too deeply into the Gothic genre prior to us doing a deep dive on both Let Them Go and Secret Rooms. So the experience of conflict between the two sisters and Rafe and that final plaintive, heartbreaking letter that Amanda writes to Rebecca trying to... You
God
see?
Damn Wendigos. Just,
they
now they're riding motorcycles.
So the secret is, those are actually motorcycles. But Greg, cut that out. we have a narrative to maintain here.
Yeah, fair enough. Absolutely. The closest thing that I would associate with that as far as personal experience would probably be some of the relationship drama of, say, Downton Abbey. I know that I read Jane Eyre when I was in high school and I couldn't tell you the first thing about it. It feels worse because it's not just a complicated, unrequited love triangle, but it's one that ends in such tragedy, not simply because the three of them can't end up having some kind of happiness together, but because Rebecca is without both of them by the very end of it, and she still has to carry on, even after she's made the decision to, at the very least, try and survive the night. So I don't think that I realized until Toby compiled the list that that was your voice behind that. So well done. You crushed all of our hearts, you beautiful person.
Well, thank you. Question mark?
Well, that's pretty much Alex's fiction in general. No, not just his fiction. Anything that he's ever done, that's the compelling part, is bringing in the feelings and the vulnerable narrative and the place where it feels okay to be vulnerable, listening to whether he's telling completely fictional stories and then getting great people to voice them, or alternately just wearing himself on his sleeve as he talks about how movies hit him in a very deep place. That if it wasn't for his willingness to do that, I don't think that I would be as big a fan of School of Movies. So let me briefly qualify that. Alex knows how I feel, as I've said it before. But for the rest of you, there are a lot of creators out there that are able to put out entertaining product or an informative product, or one that changes the way I look at things, and Alex does all of those. What I don't hear as often, specifically from male creators, is the willingness to be vulnerable before an audience, to share something of themselves, to admit fault, or regret, or pain. Certainly not without layering it behind subtext, or a distinct remove from the text if it is a fictional work. I can count on two hands the male creators that I follow that do this. Jim Sterling, Ian Danskin, Mikey Newman, the Chipman Brothers, and Lewis Lovehog, just to name a few. When in New Century, Alex is the one to often give voice to the characters that talk about the things that he cares about, or includes emotional content that I know comes from a personal space, that remove is paper thin. To men like me and Toby and a number of others that I've met on Twitter and Discord, to men who are like Alex, it makes us feel less alone, less alien. And now we are literally less alone because the fandom has brought us together. So, you know, it's great that you found a place for yourself as a part of this cast to both help bring this to a greater reality. I don't think that it would be as amazing as it is if... Okay, no, I don't want to say that because Alex already has issues where he feels like his text isn't enough, and that's part of the reason why the audio dramas exist. Alex, the text is fine. The text is wonderful. I didn't realize how much I'd love the audio dramas, and this is just me reiterating that and bringing Theo into that mix. So, okay, just keep writing, please. Please.
My emotions!
Toby, go on to number 6.
Okay, so short and sweet question. What makes Gwendolyn unique to the other lead protagonists of New Century?
I think it's just because she's so boisterous. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the story outside of Princess Thieves is very serious business. The rest of the world in New Century is very, I wouldn't say dour, but the sort of microcosm that Gwen comes from is much more lighthearted, even in its serious parts. And she's boisterous. She's sort of the human expression of bursting into bloom. Mm-hmm. And I love her. She's so bouncy and great.
We had a follow-up fun question to that, which went through a couple of different iterations. Part of Gwendolyn's boisterousness is that even among anybody else, she is the one that is most likely to fight because she enjoys it, because it gets her blood going. Mm-hmm. Is there a non-New Century character that you think Gwendolyn would enjoy having a super-powered punch-up and a sandwich with?
Oh, geez. I just got finished listening to the first campaign of The Adventure Zone.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it's consumed my soul. But Gwen and Magnus Burnside's brawls and brews.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just they wouldn't have to fight anything, you know, like a dragon or anything. They just, you know, we want to punch each other. Yeah, cool.
Unfortunately, I hit a bit of a wall with The Adventure Zone, but I listened to enough of that first storyline, which is there's a certain amount of irony behind that, because by now, me and a bunch of other people actually played through that setting as well. And it played out obviously very differently because we sprawled hither and yon and involved a whole lot more things than original. But I remember Magnus, and I think was Magnus played by the father or was he played by one of the brothers?
He's played by, I haven't gotten the brother's name straight. I think it's Travis?
Okay, yeah.
The one with the beard. I'm sorry, McElroy brothers. I'm bad with names.
Heck, I don't even know what they look like, so that's no help anyway.
Yeah, I was about to say, the beard comes through in the audio?
I think he's the middle brother.
Okay.
Because I know the youngest one. No, I think Magnus was played by the oldest brother, because the middle one played Taco.
Uh-huh. Taco. And,
yeah. Oh, God, Taco.
Mm-hmm.
You named your fucking wizard Taco?
He's an elf, right?
Yeah.
Taco the elf wizard. There's one for the history books. Someone did enormous fan art of them that I think one of the McElroy brothers posted, and all three of them look so incredibly gay, and I'm so there for it.
It's great. It's great. You should do yourself a favor and finish the balance campaign. Like all the chapters. It is worth it. Just trust me.
Okay. I'm constantly giving recommendations to Toby, so we'll go ahead and both put that one back on our list.
Yep. And it's okay, listeners who were lost. I hadn't heard of it either.
Well, of all of the kinds of content that one could take in, the one that I tend to have the most difficulty with is listening to other people play tabletop role-playing games. One of my favorite content creators on the web, Loading Ready Run, one of the things that my two roommates love to listen to are their Dice Friends campaigns. And even though I enjoy watching them myself because they're all talented sketch comedy people, for some reason I just can't keep my eyes glued to it the way I can other things that is put out by them. That also means that I've missed out on Critical Role, which is something that everybody and their cat loves.
I do get where you're coming from, because by and large, watching someone else play D&D is mind-numbingly dull. If you're not participating, and doubly so if the DM isn't that great of a storyteller.
Yeah,
it takes an exceptional storyteller to run a D&D campaign to the point where you put out a podcast and have live shows about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Griffin McElroy is one of those DMs. This story with these three idiots wandering around.
That's what I always love about D&Ds is that, like, no matter who's playing, the characters are always idiots.
As one of them put it at the very end, thank you for listening to The Adventure Zone, that time four idiots played D&D so hard they made themselves cry.
So wait, does that make the core cast of Princess Thieves four idiots and a sensible person in Oberon? Or Mortimer portrays herself as a professional, even if she sometimes gets overtaken by whatever is going on. But Robin is way too much into his own character to make good decisions sometimes. And Gwendolyn is like, oh, there's something that isn't being in a castle and having to play by the rules. I'm going to go do that instead.
She's Jack Skellington wandering around Christmas Town for the first time. What's this? There's magic in the air.
Brilliant.
And then completely messing everything up.
Alternate cut of Princess Thieves, you've got your first song number.
or better yet, Princess Thieves is actually a D&D campaign, and Merlaine is the DM trying to herd all these wacky idiots around.
That actually makes way more sense than what you might think, considering how much of a... I've used the word puppet master or mastermind as pertains to Merlaine in the past, and that feels like that would mean that there's a darker aspect to the Archmage. I don't really think that, especially not when the influences are Gandalf and Granny Weatherwax.
And isn't that a line spoken in ignorance, now that I've learned just a smidge about the most powerful witch in Discworld?
But it doesn't change the fact that Merlaine always... One of my favorite lines from... God, I don't remember what series it is now. I wanted to say Deadwood, but I am now not certain that that's true. Merlaine holds the cards so close to their vest, we're not even sure they're cards.
She's the character archetype of a chess master. She's playing one side of a chess game, and she's trying her best to get all her pieces in place so that they can do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And, but whether or not the other pieces on the board are going to follow suit is up to chance.
And if this is a D&D campaign, then the nag is the snarky roommate who insists he's not playing, even though he's still in the room overhearing all of it.
Fine, I'm a horse. Which dice do I roll?
My character sits and eats an apple. You're not going to join in? No.
I believe I was promised stew.
Oh, this is already... We're getting off the rails, but this is great.
Do you have rails?
Look, as the Iron Podcaster here, it is my job to try and construct the best narrative to be a shield for all of the White Scarf listeners out there so that they can get a sense of what's going on. And maybe I don't always succeed. Sometimes I create a sentient podcast that goes off and does its own thing. But, you know, it's not my fault. I'm just doing a job here.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting words. Have you finished?
Alex mentioned during the Princess Thieves roundtable, when someone mentioned having a lot of cats that could potentially interfere with a recording session because they were jumping up onto laps and everything. I, for some reason, thought that that was you that was saying that. Apparently, I made a mistake because you have a dog and you love cats, but don't have any in the house for allergenic reasons, not for yourself, but for family. Do you know whose cats those were and if Alex ended up using them?
I wish I could remember who said that, but my brain RAM has been cleared long since. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Alex used those sounds. I think he wanted, you know, to have complete control over the soundscape. I know he did use the O'Long Johnson cat at one point in Tiger's Eye.
I remember that.
Yeah. It's like I heard that. I was driving to work at the time, and I was like, God damn it, Alex. I got to stay on the road.
Okay, this is a reference I don't get. What is the O'Long Johnson cat?
YouTube it.
Okay.
Yeah. YouTube it. Trust me, I don't want to ruin the surprise.
Okay. Yeah,
we can't describe it.
Back to the list. Moving from Let Them Go to Secret Rooms Definitive Edition. And this is something we haven't had a chance, me and Toby, to talk about yet, because it is something that I only discovered really recently when Alex made the transition from the original published work to the definitive edition. There was actually no mention of Lucy Weatherfield.
We explain why this is in multiple places during our discussion of Secret Rooms, so I won't rehash it here.
And it feels weird to say that, because even though Toby read and listened to the original published work, I think Toby, you said that when it came out, that was one of the first ones that you started blogging on back in the day?
what, Secret Rooms?
The Secret Rooms Definitive Edition, yeah.
No, that, the Definitive Edition came later. I think I started blogging after Princess Thieves had finished, but before Steamheart had started. I was doing a sort of review of each story leading up to Steamheart, and then when Alex first tried to get the chapters of Steamheart out, I did a sort of episode by episode reaction to that. Then I took a break in the same space of time that Alex did, and then when he did Let Them Go, I did that. And then when the Definitive Edition of Secret Rooms came out, I think after Let Them Go, I did a revised visit to it. And it's one of the ones I've done in more detail than others, because all the ones apart from Let Them Go, Secret Rooms, and half of Steamheart are ones that I only did a single review on, rather than chapter-by-chapter obsessive analytical breakdowns, until the birth of this podcast, of course. But
yeah, no, there's going to be a huge amount of detail, none of which you will have heard at this point. I considered sending you some of the raw material, because I did that with Nick, but if you were going to catch up on the stuff that we'd already published about Let Them Go, you'd never have been able to. Yes, we know Wendigo. I'm sorry. I wanted to get her on the podcast as soon as possible. All right. It's really not my,
you know, every podcast fan base has the worst listeners, and ours are the Wendigos. They're just so demanding, and they always know when my recording times are. It's really bizarre.
I think, honestly, maybe they're just impatient for Alex to get around to publishing their book, Wendigos.
Well, and they're coming to us to try and bug him about it.
Well, yeah, because obviously we have his ear. He's champing at the bit to hear every single iteration of Through the Wind Door, so anyway.
And to make a long story short,
too late!
Yes, so Secret Rooms Definitive Edition. As the person who voiced Lucy Weatherfield, what lessons do you feel Lucy's friendship with James and Abigail, what lessons did she impart that helped them to move forward?
I think it prepared them for the heartache that the outside world was going to throw at them. I would have liked to see a happy triad, you know, just a happy little threesome couple, thruple, or whatever you want to call it, whatever dumb portmanteau they're using nowadays.
Yep.
Whatever the damn kids are saying.
You and your kids and your thuffles.
Get off my damn lawn. Go with the Wendigo. Go with the Wendigo.
As much as I like happy endings, I think they were at the perfect age at that point, young teenagers, to begin coming to grips with relationship issues and eventually death. Even though they were probably, given the time period, they were probably already well acquainted with death. Mm. But death of someone that you dearly love is a hard thing to do, no matter how much death you've been exposed to. I mean, it doesn't get easy anytime. Mm-hmm. Especially with complicated relationships, like with Lucy. And Lucy and the other two. And I think the complication just made it worse. Like, the what if we had done this and this and this? Would it have worked out? Would Lucy still be alive? I think as much as I love a happy ending, I think it helped prepare them emotionally and maturatively, if that's the word, for...
It's fine. We understand what you mean.
For the horrible nonsense outside the walls.
Mm. And there is, unfortunately, a lot of that horrible nonsense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This feels like it dovetails very nicely into the next part, so I'd like to move on with that before I discuss some of the insights or conclusions that Toby and I came to in regards to that relationship. Let's take your personal wishes out as part of a thought experiment. How do you feel events may have proceeded differently if she had lived and stayed with the others at Weirwood? Would she have joined James and Abigail in their future adventures?
I think she would have. She had a sense of adventure, at the very least, being willing to go outside the walls to meet this guy.
Mm-hmm. Stonewall Jackson.
Yeah. We don't know who he really was, but he sure wasn't that.
Yeah.
She definitely had a big imagination. She was a storyteller, even in small little ways. Like, hey, yeah, I'm dating Stonewall Jackson. Mm-hmm. he goes to a different school. You don't know him.
He lives in Canada.
Yeah. We got to the first.
My girlfriend from Canada. Yeah. She definitely had a sense of adventure, and I think she would have gone with them.
It's this weird thing where Toby and I have talked so much about New Century at this point, and we already know that both Alex loves to put layers on top of everything, and he has Sharon, who is the one in the family who knows all about things like Jung and psychology and such like. One of the ideas that I proposed and that Toby came on board with is that, not in the sense of like id, superego, ego, but there is a connection between left side and right side brain, and it's, your mileage may vary on, we know that the left side and the right side do different things, although it's very likely not to the huge extent that people have said, like, one side of the brain is feminine and one is masculine, or one is logical and one is emotional or artistic or anything like that. But in terms of the relationship between James and Abigail, it feels a great deal like Lucy was the thing that brought the two of them together. Lucy was able to connect with James on the more logical, analytical, scientific level, and Lucy was able to connect with Abigail on the more primal, emotional level, and that her death, as you say, it may have prepared them for the difficulty of going out into the world, but it's part of the reason why their relationship broke so thoroughly, is that they no longer had an intermediary influence to help them communicate with each other and work through their individual things. Did you feel like that at all when you were voicing this character for the story, or what do you think about that idea?
She was definitely a fulcrum. She, not just for James and Abigail, but for other people as well. She had the emotional maturity and intelligence to deal with a distraught child. And that's not something a lot of teenagers can do. She's very empathetic, and that helps connect with other people much easier than if you don't have a strong sense of empathy. Mm-hmm. And yet she was definitely like the bridge or the fulcrum between James and Abigail. And when that was lost, they sort of came untethered ever so slightly.
And probably drifted further and further away from not just each other, but from the world in general. And the act of finally leaving the safe place of Weirwood would have been the thing. It was the thing that not only forced them into different mindsets, but allowed them to come together and finally heal. That doesn't change the fact that it's still heartbreaking for them to go through, and it's always going to be there, even after the events of Steamheart and Uncivil Outlaw. At the time in the interview, I was kind of at a loss for words, and when we discussed the subject in detail as a part of our regular episodes, an idea that won't get a full analysis until I can discuss it in context with the other books, we may be able to tie this idea off more neatly. For now, what I will say is this. We all experience tragedy, pain, loss. The younger it happens, the more difficult to process. And we come up with coping mechanisms that allow us to keep going, or we break. If there is anything that life has also taught me, is that those coping mechanisms will not always continue to serve us, and it's up to us to adapt to that as well. That is the journey of all the characters of New Century, whether we're talking about James and Abigail, Hrau, Butler, Raven, or our agent Wolf, Rebecca. Some of them succeed, and we revel in it, and some have yet to. But the story is not done, and neither is this interview. In 1 week, I will have both part two of our stage show with our puissant pugilist, as well as the next part of our discussion on secret rooms. To play us out, here is a woman that has finally had enough, like Princess Gwendolyn, and is going to decide her own fate. Once more from Sarah Bareilles, here is King of Anything.
Keep drinking coffee, stare me down across the table while I look outside. So many. just keep quiet and count the cars that pass by. You've got opinions, man, we're all entitled to them, but I never asked. So let me thank you for your time and try not to waste any more of mine. Get out of here fast. I hate to break it to you, babe, but I'm not drowning. There's no one here to save. Who cares if you disagree? You are not me. Who made you king of anything? So you dare tell me who to be? Who died and made you king of anything? Oh, you sound so innocent, all full of good.
Still here? It's over. Go home. You're not going to leave until I play the gibbet reel, are you? Well, fine. You made it through the end of the music, so you've earned it.
And now, the best one.
But I read up on this particular crossroads, and it was one of the kind where they put you in a gibbet.
Oh, a gibbet.
But I read up on this particular crossroads, and it was one of the kind where they put you in a...
Where they put you in a gibbet alive.
Lie.
Buried alive.
But I read up on this particular crossroads, and it was one of the kind where they put you in a gibbet.
Gibbet? You want to change the G to a J just to remind you?
I'll have to think giblets instead. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was one of the kind where they... Why don't...
This line...
And it was one of the kind that they put you in a gibbet.
Gibbet! Jesus! Okay, this is now officially a blooper. Right, okay. I am commanding you to change the G to a J. There's no way you can get it wrong if it's a J. And if you do, wow.
Hi, Captain. Okay.
Make it so.
Gibbet.
It's not really a song, a word that anyone uses outside of medieval torture.
In my defense, there are no gibbets hanging around my neighborhood.
Well, there's none. Okay, there is one or two hanging around in mine, but we live in a historical town. It's not like I'm ever, like, hanging around in them, you know.
And it was one of the kind they put you in a gibbet.
Oh my god! How are you doing this? Gibbet! Like, shut your jibber jabber, that!
I'm gonna die. Okay. You're just gonna get it out, okay. And it was one of the kind they put you in a gibbet alive.
Ah, okay. Right, you got the wording, but just like a little more theatrical. And it was one of the kind where they put you in a gibbet alive.
And it was one of the kind that they put you in a gib.
It is not possible for you to become this monster.
Got it, what? I got it, I can do this, okay.
Right. Okay, add,
get it together.
Add next to the word gibbet with a J, three little dots. And then alive.
Okay. And it was one of the kind that they put you in a gibbet alive.
Okay, cool, we can move on.